we look at some famous puzzles, and of course you can dismiss all puzzles, says, our universe is just born this way. My initial condition just chosen, like all these causally disconnected patches the same, the universe, we just happen to, you know, it's 1 in 3 lottery, we just happen to live in a flat universe. And you know, yeah, who cares about monopoles? Maybe there was never monopoles. So you can always dismiss all the puzzles like that, but suppose we want to solve these puzzles, it can all together known as the initial condition problem. Says that why the universe can summarize it as why the universe was initially so flat and so homogeneous and so empty of troublesome heavy particles. And we saw one solution could be that if universe has been in the accelerating phase, then all this puzzle, they have to be in the accelerating phase in the pretty long in terms of how fast the scale factor has changed, not in time, but in terms of how the universe all of a sudden grow a 27 orders of magnitude. If that's the case, then all the puzzles go the way, and then we should say, okay, then we actually expect the universe to be causally connected, so there's no horizon problem, and we expect when we observe it today, it will be very flat, because this, and then we realize, in order to get that, we have a condition that we have a weird equation of state, that, this is okay too, but then we don't get our universe. So if you just have a de Sitter expansion, then there is nothing called, for the inflation, people would call it the graceful exit. You have to somehow transition to our universe, which is totally not well studied. But at least you have some hand-waving way of it might happen. But if you're sitting in just pure de Sitter, then you're doomed. It's not going to transit. Okay, so the point is that then we say, okay, if this happens, and if it happens to, let's define this again, if it happened for, if the total is defined by the initial to the end, well, the end inflation to the initial, then if it is, let's not use equal signs, it's approximate and depends on who you ask, but the 6-day FOC is what people normally quote. So if your inflation model inflated at 6-day FOC, at least you are good on the homogeneous isotropic universe side. And what we're going to say in the second half of the lecture is that inflation is designed to solve the homogeneous universe problem. It just comes with a byproduct that you can predict something measured by CNB. The problem with the inflation is it's not a one model. It's like you can write literally tons of models. If you don't put any constraint of what kind of like inflation fields potential, you can have so many models and they have no distinguishable observation. So they can't be falsified unless you say, okay, we should require this kind of thing, and you can just say, that model is too contrived, that model is just like pulling out of your head. So that's the one problem about inflation is that it's very hard to defend your model. Say, look, my model is legit because it's a scalar field. You can write any potential you want in principle. And then, you know, I was working with a string theorist, and we believe in string theory, so we believe that the model we write down have a little bit more credibility than the others that was pulling out of the magical hat. But anyway, so let's try to basically, today's plan would be try to show that yes, a single field, and it's the most familiar field, which is the scalar field, can does satisfy this condition, and it can produce 60 EFOs with some caveats. And then the second part of the lecture is we're going to talk about why we think the fluctuations are natural, and we're going to look at a toy model. We're going to look at like a bunch of toy models this afternoon in the tutorial, and one last toy model tomorrow in the lecture. Then I'll just say, okay, for the fully coupled scalar to gravity model, it's too complicated, and you're going to study in your next course anyway. But I posted the celebrated David's homework. It's really a hand, a step-by-step go through that really important calculation. But we're not going to do it. And Huang says that the homework takes 45 pages. So that if you want to follow the entire thing. But if you want to, you know, go to Kendrick's class, he'll do it. And it's an important calculation. But what we're going to do, just look at a toy model, and then we'll tell a fairy tale. It's basically, okay, we find the inflation somehow agree with our observation, but we made a lot of assumptions along the way. And especially about how to translate from the inflation era to radiation domination. That's what the inflation proposed to do, is that before this everything, because we know the universe so darn well, after 1 second, after radiation starts dominate, it will agree with all the observations so well. So inflation, if it has to happen, it has to be happen really, really far back. And so let's get started. But where we're going to start is something actually, okay. First of all, we're going to fix our geometry. Okay, you would think it's very upsetting, but yes, let's stay in this geometry that we know so well now, which is the FLRW geometry. So we're still working with a homogeneous isotropy universe, and tomorrow we will have a chance, well, very small glimpse on how to make the scalar and the metric couple and actually take care of things. But today, let's study a fixed background and throw a test a scalar field in. And then you all know, hopefully, that the scalar field is Lagrangian is given by this, taking into account the fact that we do have a non-trivial metric. I can write it like that. Okay. So I'm taking phi dot because today we're really only studying what is called the background evolution. So that phi only depends on t, it's still homogeneous. Let's say how we can relate this function, this scalar field as only function to t, to say this important number n. After all, we come up with a model. That's our goal. Our goal for the first half is produce 60 EFOs of inflation, because that's what we needed to solve the horizon puzzle, and all the other puzzles will be solved if we have that. Okay? So if I have this, so let me write down the action two. That action is just the integral. This is the invariant volume factor. And then the next one is the Einstein-Hilbert action. And then you have the Lagrangian density for the scalar field. Yeah, this should all look familiar to you. That in GR, you have seen something like that. And then the next thing we're going to do, well, we should first show the scalar field works. So we need to check, indeed, that it has an equation of state, that this is the weird equation of state we're after. We know normal ordinary matter doesn't work, radiation doesn't work. We have to look for something. So the next simple thing we can try is a scalar field. Okay. So you know there is a very cute formula how to calculate T mu nu, and it has all this functional derivative with respect to G mu nu stuff. Let's not do that. And hopefully this answer look familiar to you. Yeah? You remember something sort of look like this? I think you definitely did this in GR. Given the scalar field and find the energy momentum tensor, so I'm just going to write it up. Okay, so now is the time to calculate some energy momentum tensor. Don't worry, it's not too bad. The 0,0 component is just saying phi dot square, and that component has minus 1, so I'll just stick this guy. And hopefully this doesn't surprise you at all. The Lagrangian is given by kinetic term subtracting potential term. The energy is given by this. So you can say this is basically the energy density, which makes sense. It's the kinetic term plus the potential term. Yeah, nothing surprise. Okay, if I want to do it rigorously, I should read the index and compare to this perfectly fluid thing, and raising the index giving me a minus sign, so it all worked out. It's just as expected. What needs to be calculated is the II component, which is, that term doesn't exist, because we're doing background evolution. We're just going to toss it. And this one gave you GII times whatever the Lagrangian density is. And if you want to compare that and read off pressure, I need to read the index, which is nice. After I read the index, this is just 1. So pressure is actually equals to the Lagrangian density, which means now we can look at pressure over rho, P over rho, which is what we're after, the equation of state. And it's this thing. Right? So now, instead of actually trying to calculate something, I'm just going to take some limit. And my first limit is taking, say, kinetic energy goes to 0. And we say, W goes to minus 1. Yeah. And I can go to the other limit that says phi dot square is actually V. That's an interesting limit to take. But if you allow me to do that, I get 1/2 minus 1 divided by 1/2 plus 1, which is minus 1/2 over 3/2, which gives me minus 1/3. Interesting. So basically, we want phi dot square to be basically much smaller than V, because at V, you will reach the W equals minus 1/3, which is when the universe is actually accelerating. I put a much bigger sign just because, remember, we see some condition of the inflation. So this is just saying at this moment, yes, you have a W smaller than minus 1/3, but if you want to maintain your status, you're probably going to need, like, your restriction is probably going to be like a little more. So I should have drawn this, but now that we have done the calculation, basically it says your kinetic energy should be much smaller than your potential energy. And the one way to make kinetic energy really small is to make the potential very flat. This is really like rolling a ball down a hill. And if you don't really have much a hill, then it doesn't roll much. So that's why this model has the name called the single field slow roll model. Okay, so now we established if this thing is slow rolling, at least we have the condition to inflate, that we have W at the correct range, the acceleration is going to be, there will be acceleration. So, yep.
Could you explain again why you don't want it? Like, why you don't want the W to approach minus 1/3 DC?
Oh, it's just that I wanted this for a long time. So I want this to be maintained. If phi dot square is of the order of the potential, you're probably rolling really fast, so you're going to pick up more speed, and then you probably is going to exceed the V very quick. So that's why you want this really small, really, really small, such that it's almost negligible. Then basically the idea is not only you want the, it's rolling down very slowly, you also want that the acceleration also be small to maintain this rolling down slowly status. Yeah. So actually we'll come back to this like almost now. But at this moment, well, we attempt to solve something. We were like, okay, this could work potentially. We don't know how much inflation we can get out of this model, but there is a potential, so we need to solve something. And of course, when you need to solve something, we need to solve equation of motion. So let's take a look at the equation of motion. Well, the first one, is this guy, which is 1/2 phi dot square plus V. So that's the freedom equation. And the next one, of course, remember we always need equation of motion of the thing too, which remember that we also have the continuity equation coming from the, basically coming from nabla mu t mu nu equals zero. So let's see what this gives us. So this calculation I want to show because it will lead to the equation of motion for the scalar field. So, say rho plus p is just phi dot square. And then on the other hand, I can just take the energy density and I take the derivative. Just by definition, I can take this derivative. That will give me phi dot phi double dot plus v. It's the chain rule. Derivative V with respect to phi times phi dot. And now I can just equate them. Okay, if you're not following these steps, you will be okay. Because look at this. That's exactly what you expected. If you're not looking at the center term, this is basically equation of motion for anything. It says the acceleration is given by the derivative of the potential, and the middle thing is the very common you should get used to it now is that there's going to be a Hubble friction term. So this is our equation of motion. And if you're like me spending a whole PhD studying inflation, that's the most important equation in my entire PhD life. My life is involving put these two equations together. So basically, say h shows up here. You just take a square root of freedom equation, stuck in there, and put it in Mathematica, just run a bunch of times. So that's what I've... OK, tomorrow, if I have time, I'll tell you why I need to do it, you know, a billion times or more, or even more times. But that's my most important equation in my life of like 5 years. But it looks very simple. This is what you expected. It's the Newton's second law plus friction. OK, so now we're going to do some slow roll approximation. So the idea is, if you are actually evolving things, you probably want to say, Mathematica, undissolve this thing. OK, I also have to make it for six field. But the point is that if you really want to know how it evolves, of course, you stick that equation into Mathematica, you plot it, and then you would know. But you know, it's always good to get some analytical opinion. Like you do something analytically is always good. Then that's when we introduce slow roll approximation. It's basically there's something we introduce that epsilon, which needs to be a small number. And the eta is basically, see, they all look the same. It says we want the derivative of this thing divided by itself, which is sort of like a fraction. And then you divide by Hubble. You want this smaller, much smaller than one. You can even think about this is like a velocity of epsilon and then multiply by 1 over h, which indicates like the Hubble time, how frequently that the universe expanded by a factor of 2, say. And you wanted that to be small. So it's sort of like saying it's slow. So both of the conditions is saying that this field is slow rolling. So I'm not going to do the calculation, but I'm saying that this is equivalent to say phi dot over h, phi dot square over h is small. And this is equivalent to say phi double dot over h phi dot is small. So you can see the calculation on the lecture notes. And I look at it for a whole night and didn't really find any insights of that calculation, except you can just calculate. So basically, the idea, there are lots of slow roll parameters. Don't get confused by them. They are really using the fact that you can either state A and B are both small, or you can stay like any linear combination of them are small, so they are all equivalent conditions. So at least there are epsilon eta delta, and then there are epsilon v, eta v, at least five. But it's okay. It's not that complicated. It's really say, I want the two things too small. I can do any linear combinations as I wish. As long as they are small, the thing we want will be small. So this is what we actually want, small, coming from wanting a sustained inflation period. So the first one is guaranteed to inflate. The second one, make it sustained. If you just accelerate a bit, we're not going to get a 60 EFOs out of it. So, I mean, this is really not terribly hard to understand. This is the same condition as this one. Says the kinetic term is compared to potential energy is much smaller. Wait, I lost the square. Because h square is basically dominated by potential energy. So that's the same statement. And basically, if you look at it, it's a phi dot. So you basically say, OK, the velocity of this field is small. And the second one says the acceleration of the field is small. And then hopefully that will be good enough that this thing will stay inflating for long enough that that will solve our horizon problems. So, but this makes our life dramatically easier. So if you do this, if you do this approximation, then the freedom equation is just V over 3. It says you can drop kinetic term compared to potential term. And this is even greater. Before we have a second order differential equation, but now there's only one order. Okay, let's use approximate sign because we use the slower approximation. Yeah? So this parameters, assuming they are small, make our life much easier. I mean, even if you take the simplest potential for V, this thing is probably have no analytical solution. But if you look at this, then there is a chance. So the reason we want to do this, which I'm going to skip. It's another some calculations that you can read up on the notes. It's all there. It takes some number of lines, but it's really not interesting to do it on the board. And I'll just hand wave it says, this condition is equivalent to require this epsilon V. It's named that way because it directly relates you to the shape of the potential. So this one is not so hard to see because phi dot, this one says phi dot is something like a V prime over 3H, and if you stack this here, there, and eventually you will get this. It says V prime square, and downstairs you have H square, but H square is V. So that's all the calculation you need to do to get this one. And the next one says you can define that. So it involves on taking some derivative of this and using this back and forth. Then you realize there's probably some linear combination things. This epsilon eta is some linear combination of epsilon v and eta v. But the idea is that before, whenever you consider, okay, I have to always check, is my slow parameter, real parameter small enough? Is it going to be continue inflate? But in the particular case when we use the slow rule approximation, then the only thing we need to check is how steep the potential is and what's the double derivative of the potential. Yep.
So it's the statement that these things are also very small.
Yes, it's the same statement. So if the statement is if this is small, then these are small. And it works both ways because it's just a bunch of linear combinations. So if they're both order percentage, I mean, the thing you want is also order percentage. Okay. And you can certainly read up on how to get this one. It's not a hard calculation. It's just not worth doing on the board. Okay. So we transfer our problem about we have to solve the evolution of the system to just look at the potential. If you have a potential, satisfy that these two numbers are always small, then you are happy that it's going to slow roll and inflate. So that's kind of neat. Given potential, it's very easy to take the derivative and the second derivative. It's much harder problem trying to figure out what's H dot. Okay, so after that, then we can do our calculation. Remember, this is what we actually want to ask the question. That's the question we really care. It's about giving me a potential. Suppose it's a really nice potential that it's really flat, but can I get inflation? Can I get enough inflation? 60 e-folds, you know, it's a lot. So this, let's start very carefully that, of course, this is called the definition. Yeah, there's no problem with that. And then that's also definition, says that n is defined to be log a. And then we continue. This step is called d log a is equals to a dot over a dt. Yeah? All I could just say yesterday, I already said dn is h dt. But clear. So now we're going to do some trick. But it's not a trick that was like we're hiding things. It's just a calculation trick says this, I can do this. I can just multiply phi dot and divide by phi dot. And you're like, what did you accomplish? Well, a lot, because I manage call phi dot dt d phi. So I can integrate from phi initial to phi final. This is a good accomplishment. And then the next thing to do is to multiply up and down by h. What this accomplished is in the slow roll regime, I know h squared is basically v over 3. Okay, I'll figure out about M Planck later. And h phi dot is basically minus v prime over 3. So what all these tricks is saying that, okay, it turns out if you are in this slow roll regime, you don't have to do any scale factor evolution. It completely drop out of game. Everything is encoded in the shape of the potential. Let's write it here again. It says it's the integral over v prime d phi from phi initial to phi end. So that's it. Whenever you are given a potential, stuck it in, figure out when the inflation you want to. When you want the inflation starts, when you want the inflation end, you get a number. This number around 60, you're happy. If it's only 20, well, your potential doesn't work. Really neat formula. Has nothing to do with, you know, all the scale factor evolution, whatever. It's good to like do a first approximation. And we can do an example, which is the celebrated, what's, you know, the potential that just come up in our head is to give it a mass. That's a neat potential. We use it all the time. Scalar field has mass. How natural it is. So let's use this potential. And B prime will be given by M squared phi. And you can calculate V over V prime, which is phi over 2. So I can continue to write this thing. It says, I just need to integrate phi over 2, which gave me phi squared over 4, phi and phi initial give me a minus sign. So phi squared over 4. Of initial minus phi and square over 4. Now I just need to figure out these two numbers. So let's look at the end condition. The end condition is basically our epsilon become 1. So we want these things to be much smaller than 1. And if it happened to be 1, that's no good. So we have V prime over V, which is the inverse of that. So it's 1 half 2 over phi square. Yes. And you can check if phi equals root 2 and Planck, then epsilon V is 1, our slow roll approximation break. It's probably not going to inflate. So we're just going to take that as our endpoint. And if you stuck to there, and this is a pretty small number that we can just throw away. And now we require number of e-fold is 60. 60 times 4 is 240. And 15 squared is 225. So basically, if you have such a potential, and if you start your inflaton 15 Planck away from the origin, then when it rolls down all the way to square root 2, it will produce 60 e-folds of inflation. And of course, you know, you can produce more. You just have to be more than 15 Planck away from the origin. Yeah? So now I just threw your potential as lambda phi to the 4, or phi to the 1, which is very interesting. Very, very interesting, because I worked on that probably for 2 years. Phi to the 1. Yeah.
Can we figure out what the mass of the field is?
You sort of can. Well, okay. You sort of say that this, not really, you can give a bound. You sort of say this should be smaller than M Planck to the fourth, otherwise we don't know what's going on. And then you can put a phi equals 15 there, and that'll give you an M. And if you put a square root 2 there, you can get another mass. So you would say, well, your mass has better to be between them. Yes, okay, so.
Is there any way to like measure if this field exists or existed or something like that? Like,
well, we know, actually we can. We actually know this particular model is ruled out. So, but that, okay, I can talk about it today, but that you will sort of see tomorrow, because remember tomorrow there is a really freaking long calculation that I'll just draw a box says miracle that's by Kendrick. And we'll come to the conclusion. Basically, all the inflation model, this is also a problem. All the inflation model, it's very easy to calculate the two slow roll parameter, as I've shown you. And just from the two slow roll parameter, if you happen to have a model that is single field slow roll, you can immediately predict the power spectrum and how power spectrum depends on K. Like it's a power law, and you can predict the exponent. And then, of course, if you look at this guy, and that and epsilon is directly related. Really, just the epsilon is directly related to how much gravitational waves you can produce. And we didn't see gravitational waves. And by that, you rule out some inflation model claim to have gravitational waves, which is, you know, kind of upset, because it's inflation is in an upset situation, but not that upset. It's like, basically, if we don't say gravitational waves, okay, there are tons of models that don't produce gravitational waves. But then it's indistinguishable from its competitor. So gravitational waves is considered to be the smoking gun for inflation. Like the primordial gravitational waves produced before anything else has ever happened is like inflation's unique signature. Basically, if we saw it, we'll say, okay, let's just focus on producing an inflation model that has gravitational waves, because at this point the competing arguments actually, I think the bouncing cosmology's signature is there's no gravitational waves. So, but on the other hand, there are tons of inflation models have no gravitational waves. So this is a very like very hot topic that. Yeah, like it, well, if you are inflation model, the first thing you basically ask, do you produce gravitational waves or not? What they all do, it's just, you know, it's kind of a coincidence that it's a very famous thing called a Lise bound that tomorrow I can show, is that the inflation model that can produce gravitation model happened to be the one that the distance between initial and ending is about a 1 M Planck. So it's actually correlated, and it can be proven. And then, which means that basically you hear people talk about a large field inflation means you are transferring more than a Planck, or small field inflation means you transfer less than a Planck. It basically, the larger one produces enough gravitational waves such that a Planck can see, or potentially see, and a small one just means, okay. No, the thing is, okay, now there is direct gravitational waves detection. I don't know how much the technology is going to improve, so I can't comment on that. The problem is the current way of detecting those primordial, which means inflationary gravitational waves, is still through electromagnetic field. So basically, an interesting thing these gravitational waves is going to do is they're going to make the CMB polarized. So we have never talked about polarization. We just say, okay, look at the CMB and we measure the temperature. Everything we have talked so far is all about temperature. But actually, it's not pretty, but you can imagine that before we're only expanding like a delta T over T over spherical harmonics. But if you have something like a GIG, which has tensor indexes, you're going to, when you do that expansion, you have to use the tensored spherical harmonics, and then you just get even more complicated of those ALM that we sum over, but now you carry tensor index. And there is a scheme to how to organize them such that that it corresponding to the polarization of the photons on the CMB. And that's the way that we try to detect gravitational waves, is that we look at the CMB and hope we see those photon has the polarization have some particular pattern. And that's the problem. If you're using E&M, then you have lots of pollution. And those pollution is so big such that if you look at the foreground, which is really the background, but if you look at the background, how much pollution from the polarization of other sources, it basically says you need to be a large field inflation to produce anything that's seen, that's visible by a satellite that uses E&M waves. For all we know that now gravitational waves are very hot, you can just build really nice gravitational waves detectors that are not sensitive to all the photons. So that's the thing. But say this is a really large field, really large. If you calculated this epsilon, multiply 16 times epsilon, you get this gravitational waves to scalar ratio called R, it's root R. Okay, so that's the first part of the lecture, is I want to show you that single field slow roll inflation, given me a potential, I can just calculate something like a number of EFOs, and then you can, from epsilon and eta, later on you can predict something. It's all very nice. And the next part, of course, we're down to talk about the fluctuations. So the first thing I want to say is, why do we think fluctuation is natural? So basically, why we should have considered phi tx instead of phi t, which is just the background. Well, of course, if you think about it, it's kind of an unnatural to require this thing that has no spatial dependence, this thing, but there is actually a quantum origin to this thing. Well, we're doing quantum field theory. Where does the quantum comes in? So here is where quantum comes in, says that says basically according to the formula says epsilon is 1 is when the inflation ends. So we know the inflation ends here. And basically we're considering phi of t as a clock. It's a function of time. It is sort of tell us how far away is the end. Yeah, it's a matter of time. It says if you just look at a phi of t and you look at a phi end, you probably can figure out how long do we have until the inflation ends. And you know that the clock is not something very precise in quantum mechanics. So due to uncertainty principle that we can't really nail down when inflation ends precisely. So which means that different patches of that x different space will probably end their inflation at a different time. Because the time has some delta t, which is guaranteed to happen something else, but this is guaranteed to happen. Which means this fluctuation is going to happen, different patches is going to arrive at the ending at a different time, then which means they're going to inflate different amount. Some of them will get inflated a little more than the others because this time fluctuation. And then we know that if some place inflated much more than the others, then the density is probably going to be lower because you have a higher volume. So this is the inflation quantum fluctuation explanation of why we will see density fluctuation. So this is just pictures. So now we can see a toy model. Very funnily, we're going to use the same model, except we're going to make it even easier. This time we're going to get rid of the potential term too. And there is a square root of g, but that's a cube, because there was a square, a square, a square. So a6, then a cube. And then we have this thing. But that's not the whole story, because we have the spatial dependence, so we'll pick up a term like this. Right? That's coming from the partial phi, which we happily take it just to be this if we study background evolution. But now we have to take care of the spatial component, so that's why we want to throw away the potential. Let's just say the simplest thing. What's the simplest thing? Is that all the potential is provided by this spatial ingredient. And I'm not going to do it, but you can do Euler-Lagrangian equation. But I don't think you should be super surprised by this result. So this is what you would get if you just find the equation of motion for that Lagrange. So it's the same, you know, there's put the gradient of the spatial gradient that provides you some force, and then there is the Hubble damping. So today, we're just going to not solve that, but let's do the first thing, is that I can always take this phi, because it has spatial dependence, so I can always Fourier transform and say each mode. That's also what the physicists do, is that they were like, I can't understand this, okay, let's go to Fourier modes, see if I can find more interesting things by staring at the Fourier modes. And you would realize the Fourier modes basically satisfy the same equation of motion, except the last term is given by k square over a square phi. Okay. Yeah? So this basically, the gradients coming out become k. That's how you did the Fliess transfer. There's something like e to the I k dot x there. So now the idea is look at this and realize, oh, interesting. So this is basically my frequency. This is basically a harmonic oscillator with some damping. So let's try to look at that. And we have damping term is given by 3H, or just H, qualitatively. And the other term is given by K over A. Right? So basically there is K much smaller than AH, and there is also K much bigger than AH. And this is something actually we have seen before. Remember this 1 over AH is called the co-moving Hubble radius? So if you say wave number is smaller than this, it must be the wavelength is much bigger than the co-moving Hubble radius. So this is says this is called the outside the horizon. And if you're outside the horizon, you drop the k term, it just disappeared. And if you can look at the other term, so basically you say the mode is frozen because constant is a solution. There's no oscillation because you killed the oscillation term. And the other way will be called inside of the horizon. And now we're keeping the oscillatory term. Basically, this will oscillate. So that will be the toy model that we're looking at. So I'll quote some previous result that AH1 is the co-moving Hubble radius. No, it's easier, just look at AH. Okay, AH is basically A dot. And if I'm decelerating as a normal universe do, then A dot should be decreasing. So AH should be decreasing. A dot is the same as AH. So my picture, if I want to draw a picture, you can calculate precisely it has the decrease. I think it's something t to the minus 1/2. But anyway, not terribly important. So this is the line of AH, and now you have a mode. Now you have some thing has wave number k. What it says, if it is smaller than h, is outside the horizon, so it's frozen, so nothing happens here for a particular phi k. And but if you're inside the horizon, you start to oscillate. And then, so for the accelerating universe, of course, A dot will go up. Actually, if you think about A, W equals minus 1, it's exponentially going up. But it doesn't matter, it's AH going up. Then you can do the same thing. I have a mode. Then this is bigger than AH, so it oscillates. And there, it's over here, AH is bigger, K smaller, so it freezes. And now, it's the time to tell the fairy tale. Okay, I can continue drawing on this. So basically now, the inflationary picture is say that we can paste this two picture together. And of course, this is some sort of a fairy tale time. Because this is called a reheating, and nobody really knows what exactly goes on. But the expectation is that after inflation falls to the bottom of that potential, I mean, it's just the inflation when it goes through the steep part, it will oscillate, and hopefully it will dump the energy to standard model part. And how it's dumped? You might have heard about this in the next course, but it's certainly not settled. It's one of the problems of the inflation is that for that fairy tale, we don't know what exactly happens. So basically, the inflation suggests you might have another mode and doing the same. And then here is TCMB. And later on, there is us. And here is a satellite trying to observe things. So here is where the quantum fluctuation sets in. And then there is another, there are people who believe it, there are people who don't. And what they claim is after inflating for so long, the quantum fluctuation become a classical fluctuation. There, like one of the arguments I've seen, maybe I can mention it really quickly tomorrow, is basically, say we're really doing quantum field theory, which means we are going to impose equal time commutator. And if you impose the equal time commutator for the phi and the pi, and then if you take, then you have to expand it in some functions. We'll see a little bit this afternoon. It's, you expand it in some base function, but you have a curved space-time, so it's not just what we've seen before. And if you do everything, and then if you take this limit, which is the outside this horizon known as a super horizon limit, which means sort of the, you know, the inflation has stretched everything out, and you realize the commutator vanish. So they say, well, there is no commutator in the large wavelength limit, that must mean that at the large wavelength limit, they are the fluctuation are classical. Yeah, I know. it's not the most convincing argument, but it's an argument. So here they somehow turn into classical. And this is, and at the end of the inflation is also where we can calculate things, such as the two-point function, and then we can get a power spectrum out of this. And then, you know, things happened in the middle, and Weinberger had the theorem, says that yes, it will frozen through this period of time and coming out to some modes. And you know, these modes, there were so many modes, they could arrive at the TCMB at all different time. So that will certainly set some fluctuation. And then the story behind, after that, you know, it has all this, all sorts of effect, like from decoupling to what we observe, there's also sorts of calculable astrophysics effect. There are people taking into account. So now you have the full picture. This is the seed of the inflation, produce some quantum fluctuations, and it was transferred to density fluctuation in this mysterious period of time. And then at the CMB, it grows into a sprout. And after here, at the end of the day, what do we see them as the large scale structure? Yeah.
So on the left-hand side of the image, the fluctuations are in the field phi.
Yeah.
And then on the right-hand side, we're not supposed to be interpreting them as the field phi anymore.
No, that's where things interesting happens in between, is that the when we actually observe them, it's all in terms of 30t over t. Like if we're talking about observing. Yeah. And then there is a huge program calculate how you can start out with a profile for the two-point function because they are Gaussian. Well, we assume it's a Gaussian and people try to produce non-Gaussian entity and basically Planck didn't discover anything. So based on Planck, they are Gaussian. And if you have a Gaussian field, the two-point function is all you care. So you have some two-point function produced by inflation, and then you push it through all this time, and then the two-point function of delta t over t came out as a result. I think this is what you would learn from Kendrick.
What happens to the field phi?
That's the thing, is that what happens to the the phi is probably still around, I would say. But that's where this reheating is a very fishy part. They claim that there's lots of phi particles or phi field. It has lots of energy at the end of the inflation because it's so steep and it has so much kinetic energy. And somehow, miraculously, they dump it to the standard model particles, which is the one. I told you, it's a fairy tale. That's why it's really miraculous. Like in the middle, that we really don't have an understanding of it. And somehow, if you follow through this whole thing, and you can see the inflation prediction agrees really well. So like before first peak, this part is the part that you can match with the inflation prediction. No, actually, there's some prediction on the other side. But on the other side, there's acoustic peak. So those peak are more like a more setting, set it with the, what's that thing called? The acoustic oscillation. So that the inflation is a smaller effect. But the model that a phi to the one plus some oscillation is the project that I worked on with, of course, my supervisor and collaborators for a very long time, is that basically at the really damped tail, it's so damped that you couldn't even really see much acoustic peak. Well, they are acoustic peak, and with damping, you basically can't see anything. And our model predict there is going to be some oscillations. And it's ruled out. Well, no, it depends on, you know, how big the oscillations. But then there were so many people trying to find those oscillations because nobody ever looked for them. So once you have, it's really like a lamp post. We say, look for oscillations. And there are people who actually do the data analysis that will actually look for them and says, no, it's excluded in whatever sigma or your parameter is constrained to be however small. And it's a really fun project. So you know, it has probably the easiest potential that you can think of is that. And this is fixed. So this parameter is fixed by the power that we see in CMB. So that's not a free parameter. The only thing that we can tune at least. And of course, if B is infinitesimal small, you will never see those oscillations. But yeah, we just play with them, and then that's an exciting thing to say to be able to predict and immediately, you know, basically falsify. Well, it's not really falsified, just saying that it's not going to be very exciting because your parameter is so small that we can't see it. But there's a chance. There's like a window of a couple years that we were just waiting for some friends that who are better at looking at Planck data than us to try to study, try to see it if the data has the oscillation or not. So it was really exciting. And then, you know, you go to a bunch of seminars, like, no.